For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora koutou, no ia e Māori, Nisan Bolivianaka, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, more than 64,000 Tongans are registered to vote tomorrow, but will they show up to the polls?
Some people are migrating overseas while their names are still on the roll. Because we can't provide voting facilities overseas for Tongans overseas, I think that it will have some impact on when you try to calculate the turnout.
And freedom of speech. What does that really mean in the world of media in Samoa? And the Solomon Islands government making it easier for foreigners to do business in the country.
You are central to unlocking our development agenda. Government cannot achieve its transformation agenda alone. It is through partnerships with businesses that we will create jobs, build firms, and generate prosperity.
And the Flying Fijians take part in a new international rugby tournament starting next year. All of these stories shortly, but before we start, let's give acknowledgement that our show comes from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Agi Tupou, and you're tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, more than 64,000 Tongans are registered to vote tomorrow when the kingdom goes to the polls. Up for grabs are 17 seats for the people's representative, while an additional 9 parliamentary seats are reserved for nobles. Polling booths will be set up in each village, and while voter registration may seem high, Tonga's electoral commissioner, Peter Voki, says high levels of migration mean voter turnout is likely to be low on polling day.
The number of registered voters has increased since 2010, when we first using the current system. It kept increase from elections to elections. So right now we stand at about 64,700 something, compared to 62,000 in the last elections, which is, it will continue to increase because there are a lot of people who has just turned 21 every year. But the thing is, some people are migrating overseas while their names are still on the roll. We cannot remove anybody from the roll until we get some evidence whether they've changed their citizenship and become, they're no longer Tongans. Because we can't provide voting facilities overseas for Tongans overseas, and we don't do early voting, I think that it will have some impact on when you try to calculate the turnout with the ongoing increase of registration and the ongoing migration, of the people to other countries.
Have you found out if there's an increase of migration from your registration?
I think we can work together with immigration. They might know some, they might have some data. But just by looking at the number of registered voters from 2010, it just keep going up. And unfortunately, the number of turnout, it just keep going down. So in terms of registration, the number is going up, the turnout is going down. So
what do you think that's the cause of that?
I think part of that, that people are going overseas. And as I said earlier, because we don't provide voting facilities overseas, to just miss the voting opportunity, because our voting is just for people who are physically here.
Tonga is currently experiencing a fuel shortage. Hmm. Do you think that will have a bigger impact on the turnout with the voters?
Well, I just hope that it won't have some impact. I always look at all the cares I can see from here, but we had some discussion with the Prime Minister yesterday. He was quite positive that what the stock that we have right now can take us through the election. I mean, anything can happen. So I just hope that everyone can be able to vote. We have established a polling station in every village. So I think it should help, you know, everyone wake up on Thursday, just go to their church hall or community hall in their village, do their voting, and then they can do whatever they do on the day.
What are the challenges, finally, what are the challenges you think you'll be facing on Thursday?
Probably registration. In previous elections, you know, few people are turned out and find out that their names are not on the roll, or maybe... But that's another thing, because people are moving from one place to another place every time. Yeah. And sometimes they forgot that they have transferred their registration to some other place. But we have asked our polling officials when we did the training to make sure that they look carefully at the roll, make sure that everyone turned out is not turning away. And one other thing, we every voters need to go there with some sort of IDs, like the national ID cards or passports. Some people think that if they lost their IDs, they won't be able to vote. But it's not true. They can still vote. There are some processes that polling officials will do to assist them to make sure that they can vote.
Finally, is there any message that you would like to reach out to our audiences?
Go out and vote on Thursday. That's the most important message that I wanted to share with all the Tongan voters here. Please go and vote on polling day.
As he said, go out and vote. That's the word of advice from Tonga's Electoral Commissioner, Pita Vuki, ahead of tomorrow's national election. And he was speaking there to ABC's reporter in Tonga, Marion Gobble. Now, Pacific Beat will keep you up to date on the latest from Tonga's national election.
Do you want to know how to take better care of yourself, whether it's your body or your mind? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has the answers. Pacific Pulse brings together experts, movers and shakers, and the wise aunties and uncles from across the Pacific to break down our health challenges. From how we care for our bodies to the health impacts of culture and island living. Join host Melissa Macon for Pacific Pulse Wednesdays at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Fifteen Lover, welcome back to Pacific Beat. The Solomon Islands government says it's making it easier for foreigners to do business in the country as it looks to attract more investment to boost economic growth to keep pace with a young and growing population. Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele told a business forum in Brisbane the private sector is central to his government's development agenda. Mr. Manele and his high power delegation pointed to the creation of special economic zones as proof of his government's commitment, though others say hurdles remain for foreigners wanting to invest in the country. Liam Fox reports.
Jeremiah Manele reckons there's never been a better time to do business in the Happy Isles.
We meet at a moment of opportunity. The global economy is shifting. New markets are opening. And in our region, we face both challenges and tremendous opportunities.
And he had a clear message for the delegates at the Australian Solomon Islands Business Forum in Brisbane.
You are central to unlocking our development agenda. Government cannot achieve its transformation agenda alone. It is through partnerships with businesses that we will create jobs, build firms, and generate prosperity.
Just how important business is to the country's development was outlined by the Governor of the Solomon Islands Central Bank, Dr. Luke Farrow. He says economic growth has averaged around 3% per year for the last decade, but that's not enough.
We have a population growth rate of 2.4%. We need to grow at more than 5%. And if we do things differently and with your support, I'm sure, that will change the whole dynamics of growth.
Dr. Farrow says areas of business activity that will help boost economic growth include agriculture, resources, fisheries and tourism. He also highlighted the economic importance of the participation of Solomon Islanders in Australia's seasonal worker program, the PALM scheme, and the remittances they send home. While there have been complaints from other Pacific nations that the PALM scheme was causing local labour shortages and brain drains, Dr. Farrell says his country will happily supply more workers.
I view this as a brain gain for Solomon Islands, and in fact, I will encourage the Australian government to take more from Solomon Islands. If there's a brain drain in other neighbouring countries, come to the Solomons and take how many people you want to take, 100,000 or more.
At the forum, the Minister for Commerce, Industry, Labour and Immigration, Henry Kumar, outlined the two pillars of the government's investment strategy. One is the creation of a new statutory body, the Investment Promotion Agency.
Its establishment will allow it to streamline investor registration, approval and monitoring under one coordinated structure, empower the authority to undertake productive promotion, investor servicing and health aftercare, and strengthen compliance mechanisms to ensure consistent and transparent application of the law.
The other pillar, Mr. Kumar says, is the creation of special economic zones where businesses will be given tax incentives, help with infrastructure, and what he calls regulatory flexibility to attract quality investments.
The special economic zone strategy aims to encourage industrial diversification and regional economic development, promote export-oriented industries and value-added manufacturing, generate employment and skill development for local communities.
While senior members of the government were eager to spruik the country as an investment destination, there was a plea to do more to cut bureaucratic red tape. Accountant Greg Sojnocki specialises in helping foreigners set up shop in Solomon Islands. He says the time it takes to register a foreign investment has been reduced from forever to less than 3 weeks, but getting work permits to bring in expat staff remains a major headache. Mr. Sojnocki also half-jokingly warned would-be investors about Honiara's notoriously bad traffic, which he says can impact business activity.
There's basically one road that goes from the airport all the way to the western side of the town, and it does lead to a lot of congestion and traffic, which impacts on investors and local people's ability to conduct business efficiently.
And that's Honiara accountant Greg Sojnocki, ending that report from Liam Fox. A community health organisation in Papua New Guinea is concerned about the growing number of young people dying from sexually transmitted diseases. PNG Business for Health says of the 3,400 deaths from HIV last year, 50% of these patients were below the age of 14, and this is new and worrying. Anne Clark from PNG Bar says the impact of HIV is unprecedented.
So we're seeing something that we haven't seen before. We're seeing young people dying of AIDS-related illnesses, and we're seeing young people becoming infected, and we're seeing young women becoming infected. So it's something that we need to look at in a completely new and different way in the light of sexually transmitted generally. So not only did we talk about HIV, we talked about the many sexually transmitted infections that cause all sorts of illnesses for young women, that drive stillbirths, which drive disability for unborn children. And of course, when women are sick and babies are sick or women are infertile, we see all of the complexities around sorcery-related violence, sexually transmitted infection-related violence and infertility that drives men to find new partners. So it's a very big and complex issue.
I understand you met with some business houses in Port Moresby. What was the feedback like from these business houses in relation to what you had to present to them?
I'm just going through the feedback now, and I'm pleased to say that of all of the feedback, everybody enjoyed something completely different, and everybody thought that someone else's presentation was different and more interesting. So it really is We presented quite a varied menu of speakers. So we had someone presenting in relation to the global trends and the new innovations in relation to the testing and treatment. We had our friends from UNICEF talking about vertical transmission, and by that we mean the prevention of mother-to-child transmission in Papua New Guinea and the morbidity and illnesses related to sexually transmitted infections by women in PNG. And then we had lots and lots of presentations around the concept of what we're calling triple elimination. And triple elimination is HIV, syphilis, and hepatitis B as three infections that can be prevented with the well-informed and participation in antenatal care. So getting people to understand that it's not just HIV, but that syphilis and hepatitis B are very important life infections that can cause death and disability and illness for mothers and babies. So the processes by which parents and prospective parents, the steps that they can take to make sure that they test and treat for HIV, syphilis, and hepatitis B, and what steps they can take to manage those situations to make sure that they can have a healthy baby.
And do you think that a lot of our people out there, especially our citizens in the country in general, are taking this this news and, of course, epidemic seriously? I'm just trying to recall that we, in the last couple of years, had not enough seen awareness and information going down to, people in the rural areas and especially in the high-risk areas in relation to HIV and AIDS.
Yes, I do agree. But I think to follow that up with HIV has slipped off the agenda. I think over the last 10 years, people have thought that it was something that had sort of gone away. But I'm afraid the number of new infections in the last year are 3, 4, and 5 times what they were when we thought it was at the peak of its worst situation back in 2005, 6, and 7. So last year, we had 11,000 new infections, half of which were within young people. When I first met you in 2007, we were talking about 3,000 new infections in a year, and we were in a panic about that. Now we're seeing 11,000 new infections, and this is still something that requires lifelong management.
And that's Anne Clark from PNG Business for Health speaking there to ABC's Belinda Cora. Well, right now, let's head into the latest headlines from around the region. Manuele Tayao, yes, welcome back to Pacific Beat as we head around the region to get the latest headlines brought to you by our producer, Carl Evans, who's in the studio with me this morning. How are you doing, sir?
I'm well. It's a nice day today, actually, isn't it?
Absolutely. This For is once. What I want summer to look like, yeah. Okay, well, we're going to head to, I think it's at Niuean, the Cook Islands. They've been reassured by New Zealand that their fallout won't affect their relationship. What's happening there?
Yeah, it's an interesting this one, Aggie. So Niue, much like the Cooks, is a realm country of New Zealand. Unlike the Cooks, though, they haven't gone got on New Zealand's bad side in recent months by going off and signing a deal with China. So they've moved to reinforce their pact with New Zealand in recent days with the signing of a new political declaration, which sort of outlines their shared goals and responsibilities. Right. And as part of that declaration, it guarantees that disputes New Zealand has with other realm countries will not impact the relationships that they have with their other countries on top of that. Mm. So it's a formality, but an interesting one, I thought. It looks to me like New Zealand is sort of taking some preventative measures to ensure that they don't get blindsided again, like with what happened with the Cook Islands. Mm. Meanwhile, Niue do get some clarification and some reassurance. around some of their rights, things like citizenship, economic autonomy, autonomy, and as well as their long-term, you know, security with New Zealand.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, we head to Vanuatu. Looks like they've completed their first comprehensive media survey. What were the takeaways?
Yeah, so this might seem like something that's, you know, interesting, you know, just to us being journalists, but I do find that the way people consume content is a very interesting topic these days that really engages a lot of people. So it's been confirmed that there's been a significant shift in the way Ni Vanuatu people access news, with digital platforms and radio emerging as the most relied upon media sources nationwide. Now, this was the first of its kind, a first of its kind study, which was supported by the British Broadcasting Corporation. And the results here, Aggie, are actually quite optimistic, with evidence showing that audiences are not consuming less news. However, they are consuming it differently. So obviously, as we know, that's in contrast to Australians who seem to be going out of their way to avoid news at this point in time, which is very unfortunate for people like us.
Yeah.
However, in Vanuatu, readership online remains very, very strong.
Okay.
And that's despite the fact that print newspaper sales have declined in line with global trends. But for papers like the Vanuatu Daily Post, which is the country's largest newspaper, they still managed to attract 300,000 monthly page views.
Wow.
Which, in a country of 330,000 people, those are very, very
solid
numbers.
Yeah. Well, then I'm wondering, how are people mainly consuming news, though? Is it like through phones, mobiles?
Yeah, so the report indicates that 94% of mobile phone users in Vanuatu have internet access, and they often encounter legacy news content via social media platforms. But luckily, particularly for our show, Aggie, free-to-air radio continues to serve as one of the most widely accessed media channels across the islands within Vanuatu, particularly in areas where internet is quite patchy. So
good old school,
so
isn't
it? If media ever falls over in Australia, we know where to go.
We know where to go, absolutely. Okay, I want to head to sports now because it's high stakes for Mun Samoa overnight, who actually faced Belgium for the right to qualify for the 2027 Rugby World Cup. Gotta know, how did they go?
Oh, Aggie, my heart goes out to the Samoans who stayed up and watched this game. Not because it was bad news, but it just would have been a brutal game to watch with so much at stake and all the pressure on Manu. Like, it really was last chance saloon for them to make the World Cup. I mean, it would have been a disaster if they didn't do it. But luckily, they have done it. They have claimed their World Cup ticket with a very fought 13-13 draw in Dubai last night. They overcame a 6-3 deficit at halftime to claw their way back. They only scored the one try in the match, but damn, it was an important one with Abraham Papali'i crossing in the 63rd minute. Let's take a listen to that one.
Nice.
Driving forward, they don't want to get held up over the line. They recycle again, another advantage for them from under the post. Samoa over the line, are they? They get the try. The arms up from the referee. And they retake the lead. Win the ball at the front of the line-out. Nico Jones has it. Turning up is Papali'i. He puts it over the sideline. And that is full-time. Samoa are off to a 10th Rugby World Cup.
Yeah, so look,
well done.
Not a lot in the way of highlights, I will say. But
they made it.
Exactly. Belgium did manage to hit back after that try to level things up with 6 minutes to go, really setting up that grandstand finish. But Samoa managed to hold on and kill the ball after the 80th or 90th minute, knowing that they were ahead of Belgium on competition points. And that was the key here, Aggie. Both teams had gone through this tournament undefeated, but Manu, I believe, managed to claim an extra bonus point in one of their earlier matches, which proved incredibly vital in this game.
Wow.
And look, yeah, I mean, I know it's been a tough few years for Manu, both in traditional rugby and in the sevens, but look, this is their 10th World Cup appearance, and congratulations
to them. Absolutely. Well done, Manu. Look, and in rugby league, we believe a PNG Hunter might be on his way to the NRL.
Well, that's what reports are saying, Aggie. So PNG test hooker Judah Rimbu, household name in PNG, he's agreed to a train and trial deal with the the Perth Bears, who will be entering the NRL competition in 2027. And according to Nine's Wide World of Sports, he's expected to land a full-time contract as a result. So, look, great news if that's the case. I mean, especially given we haven't had a PNG-born and bred player in the NRL since Justin Olam, and before that it was Marcus Byer. So there hasn't been many. And he's playing for the Brisbane Tigers in the Queensland Cup next season. And from what I understand, they're going to be a feeder team to the Bears. So I guess it makes sense where that connection comes from. That being said, look, I always get a bit worried when you sort of start, you know, reporting things like this. I think it's a bit like counting your chickens too soon. I do think he's still going to need to put together a really good 2026 with the Bears to cement this contract. He has had a bit of an inconsistent 12 months as well. He sort of fell out with the British club Castleford he was playing for. But then when he got back to the Hunters, he played really, really well again. So that was great to see. And he's got so much talent. He was a former winner of the Petro Civin Receiver Medal, which is the Queensland Cup's Player of the Year. So, look, he's definitely got what it takes. And I hope a big 12 months to come lands him in the NRL.
Nice. Well, as always, Kyle, thank you so much for bringing us the latest headlines from around the region here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
Well, we turn our attention to Samoa, where the country's only daily newspaper has been banned from covering government press conferences and blocked from speaking to officials. The reason for this ban, according to Prime Minister Lauli Alemalia Toleotea Porteivau Fossi Schmidt, is due to the paper publishing misleading information. It's a claim that the paper has soundly rejected. It comes after the paper's editor was allegedly assaulted outside the PM's residence. It's a complex situation, and so helping us to unravel the situation is Samoan journalist and scholar Langipoiva Dr. Sherelle Jackson, who is joining us on the line from Portland in the United States. Malole soifua, Langipoiva.
Agnes.
Thank you for joining us this morning. Gosh, what was your reaction when you first heard about the Prime Minister's decision to ban Samoa Observer from, you know, not only government press conferences, but from speaking to government officials?
Well, it was certainly a surprise that it was such a severe reaction, given that this is his first press conference since returning from New Zealand. So I was certainly surprised by his decision.
Has it sort of happened previously, or do you think this is quite unprecedented?
So in the past, there have been cases under former Prime Minister Tula'ipa Sa'ilele where he has banned the media from, you know, from reporting on his press conferences, but the entire media. So he would take a pause on his press conferences and have only like government media be a part of it. But there's never been a case where one particular media was targeted.
I mean, how serious do you think this, I mean, or is this a threat to media, you know, in regards to respecting the rights of media freedom?
I think what's different here, Agnes, is that there's one media organization has been targeted. It is certainly a threat to press freedom because of the way that one specific organization has been targeted. And it's also a threat in that he has taken and, you know, he has made a decision that falls outside of the norm on these things. So he could easily, the basis of his decision was that two reporters came to his house and he felt that was an invasion of privacy. That sort of thing can be addressed through the law. But instead, he has taken an action as a leader to arbitrarily ban one media organization based on his dismay by their actions. There are systems in place to address those things in a legal way that doesn't have to be resorted to targeting one specific media house.
Yeah, so then do you believe then that the journalists were invading the Prime Minister's privacy by being there at his residence?
This is the nuanced piece of this case, in that the Prime Minister actually did have a cause for concern. In Samoa and across the Pacific, we have our own cultural norms and protocols that we observe in regards to our leaders. We don't do aggressive door stops like that. So there is a basis by which he has, you know, there's certainly merit to his discontent by the actions here taken by the journalists. They visited his home, and this is a private home. This is not his public residence, so to speak. So there is that. But when you have issues like that, it should be addressed by like a trespassing. Mm. You know, there are legal measures in place to address such issues that doesn't have to be resorted to this type of banning.
Well, I understand, Langiboiva, you know, the Prime Minister invoked also the Samoan cultural value of whaaaloalo, respect, or the vaatapuia, boundaries, as reasons, I think, for his disappointment in the newspaper's coverage. Do you think he's justified in that?
I certainly think he's justified in what he's saying regarding our culture. You know, this is, he's still a chief. This is his private residence, and they decided to approach his private residence. We don't, that is not common practice in Samoa or in the Pacific when it comes to our leaders. We visit them in their public offices or in their public residence. He had just returned home from a medical visit, and they had visited him at his home. This, to me, is culturally inappropriate, having, you know, reported in Samoa for over 20 years. There's also a nuance here where there are some occasions where prime ministers and presidents will accept journalists in their homes, but it's by invitation or by cultural norms. So, for instance, if the journalist is a high chief themselves or an orator and they can approach them in a culturally respectful way, that's when it is acceptable. For this particular occasion, I strongly feel that it was, you know, it was culturally inappropriate.
Mm. Okay, if you've just joined us on Pacific Beat, my guest is Samoan journalist and scholar, Langiboiva, Dr. Sherelle Jackson, helping us to sort of unpack Samoa's Prime Minister's moves to ban the Samoan Observer from covering government press conferences and, again, blocking them from speaking to officials. So, again, if I remember correctly, he did block some journalists from attending his political party rally in the lead-up to the election, right? So does this just become a pattern for him?
I think, unfortunately, this is becoming a pattern for him, where he is treating the media in such a way. So I actually shudder to think what his next steps would be.
How then should Samoan journalists navigate the scrutiny of public figures, you know, while respecting culture? Like, it can be done, right?
It can be done, and we've done it for many, many years, where we do observe and respect our leaders, cultural leaders who take office. I think as long as journalists are doing due diligence on the ethics of journalism, then there is no reason why they should be questioned in terms of how they're doing their jobs.
I do want to quickly ask, look, the Journalism Association of Samoa, is it a worry that maybe they haven't spoken out about this ban?
There's certainly been some concerns by members of the public about Joa's silence so far. I understand from sources that they are considering a statement at the moment. But it's also important to note that as of recent elections, the media has had, you know, affiliations with certain parties. And so therefore, there's in some cases, a pursuit of press freedom has been compromised by affiliations with political parties.
Finally, I do want to ask, look, the PM had said he had actually considered the ban if there was a renewed commitment to factual and responsible reporting. What do you make of that statement?
I think having public figures brand news organizations as liars or accuse them of misinformation is one of the first steps toward dismantling people's trust in the media. And it's a very unfortunate place we're in Samoan society that the prime minister is, or those in public, in the public eye, are starting to question the credibility of
our news media. I think there's two things here. One, that the media has a role to play in a fair, free and fair democratic society. And then two, the media also has a responsibility to make sure that they are observing due diligence on the ethics of reporting on public figures and on our governments. By doing that, there will be, you know, we can observe the role of journalism in our society. But at this point, attacks on press freedom, attacks on journalists, especially women journalists, being endorsed by government is really, really unfortunate. And it should be condemned not just by journalism associations, but also by our leaders themselves.
A lot of good insight there, Langi Boivan. We just really appreciate your time this morning. Faftaitele lava. And that is Samoan journalist and scholar Langi Boiva, Dr. Sherelle Jackson, here on Pacific Beat.
Join Natasha Metin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
When it comes to obesity prevention efforts, it's really important that it is a combination of diet, exercise, and intense counseling that comes with it.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've just joined us, you're tuning into Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol, and we look now to seasonal work programs. They provide economic benefits to workers and their families and communities back home. But many struggle to maximize their income thanks to low financial literacy. One woman is hoping to change that through the use of social media. Melissa Vuti, a social media personality on TikTok, posts content linking seasonal workers with financial advisors. She told Lily Rose Wellwell, it is giving workers the tools to protect themselves when working overseas.
I found this platform to address the unique financial instabilities the seasonal workers face, driven by caps in tailored support. So the biggest hurdle is, the income unpredictability, which complicates budgeting, debt management, and long-term planning for the seasonal workers.
So, you know, seasonal jobs often come with unpredictable income. Why do you think it's important that, you know, this financial planning is happening and people are being educated on that? And is it critical for those who have fluctual earnings?
Importance of the financial planning, I think it's the fluctuating earnings. They require proactive planning to avoid cash flow crisis. And also a structured plan helps bridge income gaps and prioritize essentials and also reduce the reliance and debt during off-seasons of the seasonal workers and the SWP.
Why do you think it's important that palm workers are educated? And like you said, do you see the need for it through your conversations with other seasonal workers?
Yeah. So I think it's important for all of us to learn. It's because what I realized is a lot of seasonal workers in SWP, they came to Australia or New Zealand. A lot of them don't have good educational background. So, and then I think that these sessions, they train them. They, even though a lot of us know to save money, but when we're in this foreign country, but culture shock and everything. So I think this session, they help us a lot. They help them a lot to understand more of budgeting, saving their money, and planning ahead when they go back to Vanuatu. They can invest in something that is going to sustain them in the future.
And, you know, all these informal sessions, do you think it helps with, you know, with the others that have joined in the discussion? Do you think it helped them?
As far as I know, as the trainer, Red Shem, he was giving out the training on my platform. When asking the when asking everyone who participated and everyone who's staying on the live and going through the training together with us, a lot are shy to give their feedback, but on our, like, they DM us, they private message us and putting the message in our, we have a group chat of this budgeting session team. So they put their feedback, like it helps a lot of them. Some of them are starting to save money and prioritize their needs more than their wants. There's some of them, they are saying that they find this platform and they find these sessions helpful because it helped them to plan ahead to whatever they will do with their money when they go back to Vanuatu.
And do you think it's important that seasonal workers should have a financial literacy, should have all the necessary information in relation to, you know, budgeting your money, how you spend it and all that?
Yeah, I think it's very important. It's very important that the seasonal workers should learn to budget their money and to save money and to know how to save money, how to divide their accounts while saving their money. We aim to empower seasonal workers, you know, like with confidence and to control their finances, like in long term. So this fosters stability and they reduced the debt stress. Like I know a lot of seasonal workers traveling and they're paying loans and stuff, but like it's a very important session that I think it helps them a lot to save their money and know how they spend their money when they're overseas.
And that is Melissa Vuti, social media personality, using her platform to improve the financial literacy of seasonal workers. To sport now. The Flying Fijians will take part in a new international rugby tournament starting next year. It's called the Nations Championships and it will see 12 of the strongest rugby nations play a single competition across both hemispheres. Fiji will join Japan, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa and Argentina in the south, while the northern teams will feature six nation sides: England, France, Ireland, Italy, Scotland and Wales. So to find out more, we are joined by former Fijiana captain Leilani Burns, who is now a board member and commercial manager for Fiji Rugby Union. With that, I say Yandra Leilani and welcome to the show.
Yandra Vanaka, thank you for having me, and exciting times ahead for Fiji Rugby.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, let's start with the competition format. I mean, how many games will Fiji play when the competition kicks off in July?
Sure, Aggie. Well, Fiji, like the other teams, will be competing and having six games in the initial cross-hemisphere fixture. So in July, we'll have the Northern Hemisphere teams, as you know, travelling south. And for Fiji, personally, we'll be playing against Wales, England and Scotland. And then in November, we'll travel up to the Northern Hemisphere and we'll be playing against France, Ireland and Italy. Mm. So straight off the bat, we've got six games. And then that is, of course, before we head into the final series.
Wow. Yes. And talking about the finals, so how many teams then will get to play in the finals weekend in London in November?
Well, all 12 teams will be getting the chance to play in the final weekend in London. So how this will all work is after the initial rounds, each of the teams is then ranked. So they'll be ranked from 1 to 6 within their individual hemisphere. And then those rankings will then decide who will be playing who in the finals. So for instance, we'll have first playing first, second playing second, and so on and so forth. But they'll be playing against the teams from the opposite hemisphere. So for me, what really makes this exciting, Aggie, is the concept of the finals weekend at Allianz Stadium in Twickenham. Mm. Now, this is something completely new for rugby, and it is 3 days of back-to-back double headers, and it's going to be creating a festival of international rugby. So this gives us a huge dramatic finish to the Nations Championship, and ultimately it decides not just who is the best team in the world, but also the top hemisphere in the world game.
Wow, yeah, it really does sound exciting. Leilani, why then was it important to create, you know, such a competition like this? Because do you think it's really going to help keep fans engaged in between World Cup tournaments?
100%, Aggie. In my opinion, I think it's really important that a competition like the Nations Championship was created because, in my opinion, there was a little bit of a gap in terms of the international rugby calendar. Mm. So, as we know, we had the July and November test matches or the test windows, which are great, but they never really had a bigger storyline or any real stakes apart from the world rankings, which was attached to them. So by turning these windows into a proper tournament with points, rankings and a trophy on the line, we're giving fans something more meaningful to follow. So what makes this even more thrilling is that it is the first time that we've ever had the top rugby nations in the world all come together to design one clear global competition. Now, that's a huge step for the sport. Mm. And it's the biggest evolution in rugby ever since the game turned professional back in 1995. So to answer your question, yes, the Nations Championship will definitely keep fans engaged and eager to get in all of that amazing rugby action in between World Cups and, of course, the Lions Tour. So instead of waiting for the years for the next major event, our supporters and fans now have got high-quality competitive tournaments every 2 years to look forward to.
Wow. You know, just for Fiji itself, like, does this actually guarantee Fiji more regular international matches?
Yes, for Fiji, our participation in this championship now guarantees that we are part of a consistent structure and meaningful competition. And instead of depending on our traditional tourist schedules like we have in the past, we now have got that consistent high-quality international fixtures to look forward to. So what this actually gives us, Aggie, is something that we have never had before, and that is in terms of regular, meaningful, guaranteed world-class test rugby every 2 years, at a tier one standard against tier one opponents as a tier one nation. And the impact of this will have that throw on effect through our entire rugby system. The opportunity to play against consistent tier one nations will no doubt strengthen our depth and sharpen our tactics and, of course, build our resilience out there. This also ensures that we are going to be able to remain competitive, not just in terms of the short term, but for the longer pictures as well. So for the generations to come, this will also reinforce Fiji's growing reputation as a true rugby powerhouse.
Yeah, I would like to know, though, you know, again, Fiji's joined the competition, even along with Japan, but on an invitational basis, what does that actually mean?
Sure. So from Fiji's perspective, by being able to be joining the Nations Championship on an invitational basis, it's providing us with a massive opportunity. It also provides us with recognition that we are now have reached the elite level of the global game. So the competition, as you know, they did need two additional teams to complete the Sansa group, and that was Fiji along with Japan. And in my opinion, these two teams were definitely chosen strategically. Our recent performances, our higher world rankings compared to other Pacific and emerging nations, and the way that we've consistently shown that we can compete at the world stage, especially at the World Cups, and also out there in terms of the test matches, I think this has all really played a really big part in that decision. So for Fiji being included, it's not just symbolic. We have committed to a long-term agreement to be part of this tournament, which gives us really great stability, consistent top-tier competition, and of course, a clear place in the international rugby landscape. So at the same time, you may have heard as well, Aggie, that there is a new second-tier competition which is being created by World Rugby, and that is for the other emerging nations that are coming through. And I think that's really, really great for the growth of the sport. But for Fiji, being able to be selected into this top tier signifies to us that we are now seeing a genuine high-performance nation with real commercial and competitive value. So it shows to the world that Fiji belongs at the top of the table of international rugby. And, you know, between you and me, we're ready for the challenge.
Leilani, look, as you said, you know, I understand the second division will be introduced also. But will there be promotion and, you know, relegation between the two tiers?
I believe so. I mean, we have to wait for the official announcement to come out. So I guess time will tell.
Well, there's been reports, though, that Fiji will host its matches on neutral ground and not in Fiji. Can I ask why this is?
Sure. Well, the venues haven't been confirmed as yet, but neutral venues are being explored at present. And that's, of course, for the July fixtures. And then, of course, when we are hosting our games, they will be played up in the Northern Hemisphere. But there's really multiple factors that we need to consider in terms of our actual venues. And what is being currently considered is including player welfare, high performance, logistics, and to be able to identify suitable venues to support international rugby events. So, as I said, venues haven't been confirmed as yet, but We will definitely let everyone know once they have been, and it's definitely an exciting announcement, so make sure you stay tuned for that one.
Well, I'm wondering, Leilani, because, you know, maybe playing in neutral grounds and bigger stadiums potentially, do you think that means a bigger boost in income?
Definitely. I think, you know, being able to have these new opportunities to play in venues that we haven't traditionally hosted at before, this opens up to this whole realm of more commercial partnerships and opportunities. So I do believe that it will take us to the next level.
I'm wondering though, you know, with Fiji now officially considered a Tier 1 rugby nation, I mean, if so, what does that mean for the women's team?
Sure. Well, Fiji being considered as a Tier 1 nation, obviously that's a huge milestone for us. And to be able to be recognised at this level provides us with that regular access to high-quality international competitions. And that also means that Fiji is able to stand alongside the elite of rugby nations world. So in terms of our women's team, as I mentioned earlier, this recognition is definitely going to be beneficial for our whole rugby ecosystem, which also includes the women's program. So that Tier 1 status brings greater visibility, stronger pathways and more investment into the performance structures across both our men's and, of course, our women's game. And also we'll be able to strengthen our case for more regular test opportunities for our Fijiana women's team. It also will provide better resourcing and deeper development pathways for our young and upcoming players as well. So basically, in short, Fiji becoming a Tier 1 standard raises the expectation and opportunity across Fiji's rugby landscape. And, of course, it provides our women's team the opportunity to be able to benefit from that momentum.
Leilani, you know, as we were talking, I was just thinking back to, you know, talking about the stadiums where the teams can play. Like, do you think you will target grounds in countries with a large Fijian diaspora?
We would be definitely be calling on our diaspora to be coming out and to be able to support our team. But we're also looking at making our scientific data-based approach. So we have partnered with industry heavyweights such as CAA Porters to be able to go through and conduct scientific studies to make sure that we are analysing each of the venues and making the best decision both for our team and for the commercial opportunities as well.
Quickly want to just try and get this in though. Flying Fijians playing Spain this weekend. We've got about 20 seconds. How do you think they'll go?
Well, you know, I think that we've got a great match. I know that we have been quite dominant when we played against Spain previously, but, you know, at this tier and at this level of competition, you can never rule anyone out. Just looking back at the competition so far against England, we really showed great physicality and skill, but unfortunately moments of indiscipline did cost us. But I think we've learned from our mistakes from that and also against France, and I'm very, very positive with the game ahead, and I know that our boys want to finish off this tour on a high. So
absolutely,
I'm looking forward to what we have in store.
Thank you so much, Leilani. That's all the time that we have.
Vinaka.
Vinaka. That is Leilani Burns, board member and commercial manager for Fiji Rugby Union, bringing us to the end of the show. But we'll be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Up next, it is your news. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, I'll do it off atu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.